Welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to episode 71 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. And right off the top, I hope you can hear that my voice is in better shape than it was in episode 70, but I do thank everybody who sent me little get-well wishes over the last few weeks. Well, do you know those great big books that can squash an entire army of ants? 1001 movies you must see before you die. That seems like a pretty good idea for a website, don't you think? That going through all of those films and seeing if you can actually see one of all of these 1001 films. Well, that is exactly what my guest today is trying to do. He has gone through all of the editions, which now have actually tallied it up over 1100 films, because films get added and taken off as the years go on. And he's, what did we say, 80% of the way through?
70 to 75%, not quite
80% of the way through the 1001 movies you must see before you die. So I think it goes without saying that my guest today is very well-versed and very ambitious, and we're very pleased to have him here because he's going to just bring the bar up on the whole show, because Lord knows if it was just me, it would be a mess. We are across the wire to Illinois tonight, where we are talking to the brains behind 1001plus.blogspot.com. Please welcome Steve Honeywell to the show. How are you, sir?
I am well. And yourself?
I am much better. I was on death's door for a while, which was great for DVD and Blu-ray watching, but not so great for everything else.
Yeah, that's why I can't catch you.
Yeah, I'm too sick. That's the problem.
You're about 20 ahead of me for the year, and I think it's going to remain about 20 ahead of me.
That's so sad.
That's all right.
If you want to learn more details about Steve and the recording of episode 71, check out the Twitter series I call Mike and the Mechanics. You'll find those if you follow my Twitter feed today being Monday, November 5th, or by searching #MATM71. On episode 71, we'll be discussing Cloud Atlas. We'll be finding out people's sick day movies, appropriately enough, and we'll turn the record over and play the other side. Before that, we need to learn more about Steve. This is Know Your Enemy. Mr. Honeywell.
Yes.
What is the first film you can remember seeing in a theater?
The first movie I have any memory of in the theater is Disney's The Aristocats, but I have almost no memory of it. I just kind of remember bits and pieces. I think I was three.
I remember that one. That's one of those ones, like Disney used to play them every 4 or 5 years, right? Back in the days before home video.
Yes, but I'm old and I actually saw it on its initial release.
I wasn't quite going there. I was giving you an out. You could have said you saw it at, you know, some re-release in 1985. Nobody would have known.
No, I saw it in like 1970.
Wonderful. and you got like no memory of going or who took you or anything like that?
I'm sure I went with my mom. I had came from a fairly large family, so movies were not something we did very often. The first movie that made a real impact on me would be Star Wars.
Hang on, back up a step here, because this is interesting. Large family, so movies weren't, like, you guys didn't go very often, I guess, because there's a lot of siblings to pay for?
Right. If we went as a family, it was 7 tickets. And it's, too much. So movies in the theater were not really a thing for me until I was able to go on my own.
Right.
So Star Wars was the first one that had a real significant impact on me, and I guess I was 8 when that was released.
See, you know what else I just got to thinking of? I can also imagine getting 7 people to agree on one movie couldn't have been that easy. Even with, like, I'm sure the choices were a little bit more limited, but still.
Yeah, there's some truth to that, too.
What was one of the last films you saw?
Well, I'm prepared for you to be upset with me. One of the last films I saw at home was War Horse, and I really didn't like it.
Okay. Yeah, because people know that I'm a fan of the War Horse. What didn't you care for about it?
I thought it was really emotionally manipulative. I mean, Spielberg's always sort of emotionally manipulative, and I always get the feeling that, you know, anytime there's something, some big emotional moment going on in a Spielberg movie, that he, you know, sits down and rests his chin on his hand and thinks, there's got to be a way I can wring just one more tear out of this. And it was in full force in War Horse. So,
you know what's funny? So a couple things have happened since I saw that film the first time. Mainly, I went and saw the play. It's been here in Toronto, and the play, if anything, it actually gets a lot more haunting. Because when he goes off to war, like all the World War I scenes, which is the entire second act and basically like the end of the first act, it's really kind of chilling. There was actually a 12-year-old in front of me who was quite upset by what he was seeing. And it's kind of strange because it's all these, they use kind of those large scale puppets like they did in The Lion King.
Mm-hmm.
So in watching that and then thinking about that, I thought, you know, Spielberg sort of nails Warhorse the best when it goes into battle.
No, I agree with that. I just think it has a tendency for me to get kind of maudlin. You know, there are times when I didn't think the ending was ever really in question. And he's sort of, you know, Joey the Miracle Hercules Jesus horse, and it gets a little bit much.
Yeah, I can see that. Like, it's, you know, it's one of those ones where when I wrote about it and when I watched it, I knew I was leading with my heart. Like, I could tell exactly mm-hmm. what he was trying to do, but damn it, I fell for it. And it's just one of those things, you know, we're sort of going to talk about that with today's film, but it's one where I stand up for it, but I don't get into fights over it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and I won't either. I mean, if you love the movie, you love the movie, and I'm fine with that. It just didn't work for me. Okay. And that's where it's going to be. It's a valiant effort, and it's a pretty movie.
Yeah.
I will not dispute the fact that it's gorgeous, but the story just kind of fails for me.
No problem. Yeah. What's one of the worst films you've ever seen?
So I've been asked this actually recently elsewhere, and I would say that the most incompetent movie I've ever seen is Birdemic Shock and Terror. And if you've seen Birdemic Shock and Terror, you know exactly what I mean. And if you haven't, I'll just say that an average 9-year-old can put together a better movie. But as far as just like a movie I never want to see again, the movie that said is sort of morally evil, it's Sallow. I never, ever want to have anything to do with Sallow again.
Okay, you need to fill me in here because I've heard like Harbingers of Doom about Sallow, but I actually don't know what it's about. And believe it or not, there's a pretty good used book in movie store up the street from me, and they've got a copy, and I keep reaching for it just kind of out of curiosity's sake.
You know, it's the problem with Sallow is that it's really well made. You know, it's a well done movie, but it's this group of fascists who essentially kidnap like 20 young people, take them off to this country house, and then do unspeakable things to them for 4 months.
Oh, man.
And there's not really any resolution. I'll keep this as clean and as clinical as possible. The middle section of the film deals with coprophagia. Phagia meaning eat, and copra meaning something you do in the restroom.
Thank you.
Yeah, there you go. And it's pretty graphic as wow. far as that goes.
There's a criterion of that, dude.
Yes, there is. And it's the only time I've ever watched a movie and thought I was going to throw up in my own lap.
Was that in the 1001 list?
Yes, and I got it done early and I'm happy I did.
Oh, boy. I think I'll take your word for it and just take a pass.
Yeah, I think you're probably the better man for it.
Anytime I hear those, as I said, those Harbinger of Dooms around a movie, I certainly get a little nervous, and now I see why.
Yeah.
Well, this ought to be interesting given your whole mission here. What is a classic or essential that you have not seen?
You know, I thought about this one carefully, and since we were recording this just before Halloween, I thought it would make sense to go with a scary movie I've never seen. I am a fan of the 70s and 80s classic horror. And the one that I am missing is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Wow, really?
Yes.
Oh, man.
However, by the time this airs, if everything goes to plan, you I'm actually planning it. On watching it on Halloween.
Okay, but just like I'm going to hold your feet to the fire that you got this far. Because even I, who do not like horror and I'm a like gigantic coward, even I've seen that one. And you know what?
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Well, and I can actually compound my sin here. I own a copy.
Yes, that in my eyes, that like the only thing that you could tell me that will make that a more a grievous sin is if you tell me that it's still shrink wrapped.
No, it's
okay.
Not.
You opened it, but you have okay. We call that the Bob Turnbull special. I'll be really curious to read what you have to say about it. It's a really, really well-made horror. I'm with you. Those 70s horrors, especially stuff like that. And, and Halloween and The Omen. Yep. And I know it's going back into like the late 60s, but Rosemary's Baby. Those are the kinds of horror movies that I'm really gravitating towards. And, that one, it's got some great stuff in it. You're in for good things.
Yeah, I'm excited to see it. That was the thing from 1982 that got me hooked on horror. So not actually too much after the release of this, and I've sort of gone back and gotten through all of them. And it's just one I keep reaching for and go, not today. Yeah. And then put it back. Yeah. So
make sure it's nighttime, make sure the lights are out, and buckle up. Last but not least, what is a film that for any reason, sir, you wish had a hand in making?
Another one that I put a lot of thought into. And I was of kind of two minds. I think, a lot of times you ask this question when people say a movie that they love that's really meaningful to them. And I decided to do something different here and went with a movie that I really wish had been better. And that is Danny Boyle's Sunshine.
Oh, you're going to fix the ending, aren't you?
The first 2/3 of that movie are so good.
Yes.
As good as any science fiction I have ever seen. And the last third just goes so off the rails. And I like to think that if I were involved in the making of that movie, I would have had the sense to raise my hand at one point during a script meeting and say, ending kind of sucks. Can we change this? Because up until there's a particular moment in the film where it turns into a monster movie, and it's such a disappointment. And it could have been so good.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of funny too because Boyle. I've seen Danny Boyle at TIFF like 3 times now. He was here for Millions. He was here for Slumdog Millionaire, and he was here for 127 Hours. And I can't remember which of those times that he was here that in the post film discussion he brought up Sunshine. Like it just in mentioning it in passing of something to do with, I think it might have been the DP, like the cinematographer he worked with, or the crew that he worked with, or the composer, or something like that. He brought it up in passing, and like a few people in the back of the theater cheered, and he actually stopped cold. He goes, "Oh, sure, you're cheering now. Where were you 2 years ago when it released? Because nobody saw that."
Yeah, it's. If you haven't seen it, I recommend watching it to about the midway point.
I'm even okay. Like I can see you're right. It's if you change that third act, it turns into something epic. It really right. turns into something amazing. But even with that, I think maybe I even like it because of that. If that sounds weird,
yeah, it's sort of a wounded animal.
Yes,
yes I feel kind of sorry
it's,
for
it's
it.
It's very wounded.
It really is though. The start of that movie, the premise is interesting. It's gorgeously shot.
Yep.
It's an absolutely beautiful film. It's really smart. The characters are really smart. And I really appreciate that. And then it just turns into basically a slasher. And I just kind of throw my hands up.
Right. Somewhere in England right now, Simon Colum is nodding along with all this, although he might take us to task for not liking the last third.
Fair enough.
Yeah, exactly. That is Steve Honeywell and all his glory. And thank you very much for all that, Steve. We're going to take a quick break here and hear from you fine folks. It's your chance to come on by and talk to me. Well, last episode, in my beleaguered condition, I asked people, as I was surrounded by DVDs and Blu-rays and watching far more than any person should on an average week, I asked people what they surround themselves with when they're feeling under the weather, and I got a lot of varied answers. Somebody woke up Ryan Helms. Univarn himself wrote in and said, "The Lord of the Rings, Extended Editions 1, 2, and 3. Nothing charges through a sick day like an epic that you know you can fade in and out of without missing the beat." One of the last times I was sick, my wife said, "Put on Lord of the Rings. That's my sick day movie." And I swear to God, man, that is not my idea of a fun sick day. I just can't do it.
And see here, I don't want to spill the beans, but I'm going to, because that was my answer.
Oh, boy. Well, okay, we'll come back to that, because somebody else does mention it, but we'll come back to that. Jess Rogers from Real Insight said that she usually goes for the comforting TV shows when she's sick. West Wing, Friends, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, or her standby film, Sense and Sensibility. Nikath from Being Norma Jean said, I don't have a particular kind, but I do go for Michael Cera movies when she's down. Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, Juno, and Superbad. Red George said, lots of Chris Farley. If I'm going to feel like shit, I'm going to watch something that will get me laughing. I can't laugh when I'm sick.
I'm with you.
You know, it depends, like, especially if I'm coughing, because that just gets me coughing more.
I'm way too angry when I'm sick. When I get sick, I feel upset that my body has disappointed me, and I'm usually just unpleasant.
I see. I just want to be left alone. Just, like, give me a bed. Yep. Don't bug me. I'm fine. Yep. Stevie Taylor in New Zealand said Waitress, which is bad because that movie makes me so hungry, and 9 times out of 10, I won't be able to eat anything. She also says The Help, Singing in the Rain, anything black and white. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. That's a long one for a sick day. Any soppy romantic comedies? I have the worst immune system in the world, hence the long list. Oh, okay, she's curated it. I see what she's saying. Dan Heaton, the public transportation snob, said sick days are different now with his daughter at home. But in the past, my go-to was L.A. Story with Steve Martin. Now, I don't know why you can't. Can you? I haven't seen L.A. Story in a long time. Can you not show that to a daughter?
I would think it would depend on the age. There's no nudity. I don't think there's a lot of language. There might be some language in it.
Sam Fragoso says he goes for comfort. High Fidelity and Groundhog Day. Peter Chu, a local here in Toronto, said it used to be Groundhog Day for him. That was his type of feel-good movie. This one gave me a smile. James Blake Ewing of Cinema Sites said that his sick day movie is Lost in Translation. And if you know James Blake Ewing, that makes complete sense. I'm surprised you didn't say something like Ohazar Balthazar or something like that. I kind of expected that. Sorry, James. We love you. We really do. I don't mean to tease.
I figured him for a lot of Kiarostami.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, right? Right.
James is watching a lot of Iranian films when he's under the weather.
Yes, yes. He's watching like Certified Copy or something.
Right.
I can just picture him huddled in a blanket, bowl of chicken soup, and some Iranian cinema.
No? Taking notes on Mohsen Makhmalbaf.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Rachel West, friend of the show, said Newsies on loop. It's the only known cure for a sore throat. Another friend of the show, Lauren Simmons, said that she cured her stomach flu with So I Married an Axe Murderer. Again, I'd be laughing too much. I love that movie, and it is comfortable, but I'd be laughing way too much. Rachel Thoreau, also from Real Insight, said, if it's just me, then Clueless. If it's me and the kiddo, since we share all of our germs, any one of the many Disney films. We're getting down to the end here. Will Malone in Australia said, strangely, I tend to avoid movies when I'm sick, preferring to reach for a TV season, such as The West Wing. It's been very medicinal. But if TV is ineligible, I will take comfort in the known and trusted. John Hughes films like The Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller work very well in particular. Johan Ander from Sweden said, I rarely rewatch movies, but it would probably be an adventure thriller, matinee type thing, like Shoot to Kill with Berenger and Poitier. Berenger and Poitier made a movie? Have you seen that, Shoot to Kill?
No. No, oh, but I need to look.
I almost want to stop this cold and look that up. But
I'm going to do that while you're talking.
Okay, please do, because I got one more to go. Jessica from the Velvet Cafe, also from Sweden, said, to be honest, I'm never home from work sick. Well, that's a trooper. But if I was, I think I'd watch the first seasons of All Creatures Great and Small. I've never indulged in the All Creatures Great and Small. I know my parents dug that, but there we go. That is a varied list. What did you find out about?
I'd say that All Creatures Great and Small is my mom's favorite show. And yes, Shoot to Kill does exist. 1988, Sidney Poitier and Tom Berenger.
Wow.
And Kirstie Alley.
I almost want to see that on a dare now.
Also Clancy Brown and Richard Masur.
I must see this. So, okay, so we sort of spoiled the answer, but really your sick day go-to is The Lord of the Rings?
It would be one of my choices, but there's a part of me that when I was a kid, my brother Tom and I shared a room for a number of years. And so when he was sick, I was sick. And at that point in his life, he watched a lot of sort of the 1960s World War II movies. And so that's a comfort thing for me when I'm sick, is to watch something like A Bridge Too Far or The Dirty Dozen or The Great Escape or something like that. So
yeah, that's better.
Yeah.
And the good thing about those are also long. Like you can drift in and out of those.
Yeah. You know, put on Bridge on a River Kwai and sort of, you know, pay sort of marginal attention.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know why the Lord of the Rings don't do it for me. On a sick day, it's really kind of hard for me to nail down. As I said, like, one of my sick days this year, I tried watching the extended edition of Fellowship or Two Towers. I can't remember which it was. And it was making me sick and bored. But it's kind of strange because my sick day goes to when I'm feeling rotten, I want to see people who have it worse. So I'm putting on like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo or No Country for Old Men. I'm putting on the grittiest stuff I've got.
See, maybe you should buy Sallow.
Yeah. Okay. And the next sick day I go, I guarantee you that copy is going to stay in that shop for months. The next sick day I have, I will go buy it and I'll say, Steve told me to.
That was a joke. I don't wish that on you.
Maybe drifting in and out of it would help. Well, there we go. That definitely, everybody's got a different mood when they're sick. That's really, really cool. Lots of light stuff, lots of drama stuff in there. Thank you, everybody, for writing in. For the next episode, for episode 72, we're going to be talking about a lot of James Bond in that episode, and I want to know people's thoughts on James Bond. Do you have a favorite film? Do you have one? Do you not like it at all? There's been obviously a lot of attention paid to Bond, given that it's his 50th year, but I'm under the impression that there's people out there who either just don't care or are shining it on, and I'm giving you an avenue to step up. I will not judge. I want to know the truth. What are your thoughts on James Bond, for better or for worse? Let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, where you can find me, I'm matinee_CA, Facebook, where it's facebook.com/darkmatinee, or just leave a comment on the site. That will take us to this episode's new slang, and the new slang is Cloud Atlas. Cloud Atlas is co-directed by Tom Tykwer, Lana Wachowski, and Andy Wachowski. It is written by those three, Tykwer and the Wachowskis, based on the novel by David Mitchell. It stars Tom Hanks, Halle Berry, Jim Broadbent, Jim Sturgis, Duna Bay, Ben Whishaw, Susan Sarandon, and Hugh Grant. To summarize the plot would take quite some time, so in a nutshell, it's six different storylines where there is some crossover in terms of theme and relationship spanning over the course of about 3,000 years. So we reach back as far as the 1800s and we push forward to a future that is set, that it just says 100 years after the fall. So it's a very wide array of stories, all of them having to do with life and death and love and betrayal and so many more things that people are both loving and hating. Steve Honeywell, where did you come down on the divisive film that is Cloud Atlas?
I got to tell you, I am surprised at the number of people who haven't really liked it. I thought it was beautiful.
I did too, and I was kind of worried about it, to be honest, because I saw this 6 weeks ago or so during the Toronto International Film Festival, and for a moment or two, I thought I was watching it through what I call TIFF goggles,
right?
Where something that's pretty good seems really good only because you're in a jacked up house that's prepared to love things. So I was worried that I was over effusing about the film. I'm sort of surprised that it's split people as much as it has.
I guess in a sense, I'm not surprised that people are having trouble with it. And I will say that I think you have a real advantage over me in that you have seen it twice, and I have only seen it the once. I don't have a problem with seeing movies a second time. I love seeing movies a second time or a third time. But it's rare that I will say this is a movie that you really need to see a second time or a third time. And I think that's the case with this.
Well, see, it's funny that you mentioned that. I'll be honest, the only reason why I saw it a second time was to have this conversation, because having seen it 6 weeks ago, there are a lot of films in between then and now, and I would have been really reaching to actually have a thoughtful conversation about it had I had to reach back quite that far, because there's so much going on. I will say, though, what did help me quite a bit is in between viewing one and viewing two, I read the book.
Ah.
That actually really helped. But no, I'm with, like, you know, not to get too far off on a tangent, but as much as a fan I am of telling people to watch things a second time, because sometimes you get all these other little things from it, you know, it's a time and money thing. And even still, there were a lot of other things I could have done with 3 hours. Like, there's a lot of other things playing than watching the film again. So as much as I think that was a wonderful benefit for me and something that made me fall for the film further, it's not, I wouldn't say it's a necessity. I think if somebody watches it once, they're either going to get it or they're not. Like, as much as I like to say watch it again, I think that what you take from Cloud Atlas says kind of a lot about you as an individual than it does as you as a movie fan.
I can see that. I think it's a movie that benefits greatly from a second watch, though.
Oh, sure.
I mean, I think I walked out of it with a pretty good handle on it, but I think I very well may have been the only person in the theater I saw it in who walked out with any kind of handle on it, because there was a lot of puzzlement. Now, I will also say that I saw this at an 11 a.m. matinee, and I didn't realize that when you go to an 11 a.m. matinee, everybody in the theater is older than 60. So I was by far the youngest person in the theater, which is a shock, with maybe one or two exceptions. And there were a lot of people who I think were kind of expecting something that they didn't have to think so hard about.
Oh, boy. No, they were screwed.
Yes.
You know, part of the thing I wonder about with this film, the one thing that it was pointed out by some of my podcasting brethren, the guys on Memo, is that this is a very earnest film. It really wants you to think about the greater things that how we proclaim that we want to live. Things like being an honest person, being a good person, and believing in doing right. And I kind of wonder a couple things. First of all, I wonder if the resistance to this film or the people who fall for it, if it has something to do with the level of earnestness that you're willing to buy into.
Possibly. I know. I think that in a very real sense, this is a film that requires you to there has to be a buy-in at some level. There also has to be a willingness to really work at this film. I don't think this is one, you know, and I'll name a movie I love, like Die Hard. You don't have to think real hard when you watch Die Hard. Die Hard just kind of happens and you know, things explode and you go, woohoo. And that's great. This is not that kind of movie. You really have to, you know, pay close attention and work your way through all of these six stories and see where they're going and try to make connections, because the connections between them are not nearly as obvious as a lot of people might want them to be.
Well, see, actually, that's the funny thing, is not to diverge this conversation too far, but the difference between the film and the book is the book takes the six stories and basically swings through them like a pendulum. It goes from the furthest one in the past through the years out to the future, and then works its and tells basically half of each story, the complete future story, and then works its way back telling you the second half of each one. The way this film cross cuts through everything and basically weaves all six together, it brings out all of these parallels that were in the original text that just you would have glossed over had it not weaved them all together like that.
I like the weaving together, and I think it makes that more evident.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's necessarily as overt as it would be in a lot of other movies. I think, you know, it's something that you have to be willing to tease it out for yourself.
That's true. The one thing I'm curious about is kind of getting back to the resistance to people liking this film, is the one thing I've heard, and not to point fingers at anybody, but I've heard the idea that the thesis of this film is very basic, and it's one that we already know. But the point that gets brought up in this film is, at one point, the Louisa character, one of the roles played by Halle Berry, she's reading these old letters, and her neighbor asks her, why do you keep reading these old letters? And she says out loud, maybe, she goes, I'm reading about people making the same mistakes we all do, and wondering why we keep making them. And I think that's one of those things that I latched onto about this film is, yes, all of these ideas of do right by other people and karma and whatnot, it's not new. It's not, you know, the idea that a corporation is not going to look out for the best interest of its employees is not a new idea. But yet nobody in the world seems to be able to let that sink into their head.
Right. And I think it's something that we all know, but it's a lot of times it's an idea that's so, maybe it's so fundamental we never really think about it.
Maybe.
And this is a movie that brings that forward. The other question is, yeah, okay, you're right. A corporation is never going to care for people the way people are going to care for people. You know, I'm not going to trust McDonald's to feed me, you know, food that's decent when they can get away with food that isn't, if I'm going to buy it anyway. We keep, you know, she says it, we keep making the same mistakes. Yes, we all know this. If we all know this, why do we keep running off the same cliff?
Yeah, and that's one of those things is that, yeah, it is an obvious question, but we have to ask the question because we still keep doing it.
Right, yeah. If we weren't making the same mistake anymore, then this would be a movie that we could set in the past and ask the question.
Exactly.
The fact that it goes well into the future means I think we're sort of, you know, doomed to keep – all it takes is for one person to be selfish.
Yeah. Now, I have a question for you.
And to do that, and then we have the same story.
That's right. I do have a question for you. Does the film's audacity gain it any currency? Because – it's the one thing that I see people bring up a lot is, you know, yeah, it's daring, or yes, it's epic, or, you know, so on and so forth. But, and I, for me, that was actually one of the selling points, is the fact that it's a really daring film, and the fact that it got made is the win for me. But does that really gain it any points?
I don't know if it gains it any points. I think it might gain it some initial interest. It's great to be daring and it's great to be ambitious, but if you don't live up to it, you know, well, then you just reach too high. I think it does live up to its ambition in a lot of respects, though. And so I'm glad they went for it because I think they got there a lot.
Yeah.
There are some stumbles, but, yeah. You know, that's okay. I'm happy with that.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things I was thinking about earlier in terms of its audacity is it's a two-director project because the Wachowskis work as one. And let me ask you this. If you had to place bets, do you think you could figure out, like without looking it up, which storylines were done by the Wachowskis and which storylines were done by Tickver?
I can almost guarantee that the closer future story, the one in the Neo-Soul,
yep.
That's Wachowskis.
Okay, but that's one out of six.
Yes, I can almost guarantee that one is them. I'm going to guess they might have done the distant future one.
Yeah.
And I got to think. Now you're going to make me think.
See, here's the thing. The fact that you have to think about it this hard tells you that the two collaborators, the three really, they married up very, very well.
Right.
You know, it's not an omnibus of a story where really and truly it is, but it's not that kind of story where you would have something like six different directors and see six very, very different styles. Even though we know what stories they would have picked, they marry up really well.
I agree. And the reason I'm pretty sure they did the Neo-Soul story is because they've always been very smart with incorporating future technology. Mm-hmm. Very, very smartly. One of the things I like is the attention to detail in that, where you've got, you know, the whole futuristic flying car thing. One of the questions that nobody ever answers is, how the hell do you regulate traffic when it's suddenly in three dimensions? And what they did was they put these holographic roadways that people can quote-unquote drive on that makes perfect sense. It's a perfect solution. It's a smart and simple solution, but that's a really good attention to detail. It's a great addition to the genre as a whole for science fiction because it is so sensible, but that's the kind of thing that they seem to think of.
You know, it's one of those things. I'm not the greatest fan of Speed Racer, but I like it for what it does. I think that's a film that actually kind of needed to be smaller, if anything, but I like it for what it wants to be. I've never seen Bound, but of the rest of their films that I have seen, I like what they do. And if anything, I just wish that they did what they do more often. By the by, the third story that was theirs is the 18th century one on the South Pacific.
Okay. I will disagree with you on Matrix Revolutions, although I will also say that I basically opened my review of this by saying, thanks to this, I now forgive them for Matrix Revolutions. But yeah, I agree. I like – they're smart filmmakers.
Yeah.
And that what I respect about them is that they assume that I'm smart.
Yes.
And I like it when a filmmaker doesn't feel the need to force feed me everything. Yeah. I have a brain. I'm capable of making connections. Thank you for respecting it.
Well said. Now, the one thing I kind of want to bring up before we get out of this is there have been two big criticisms of the film, and they both really bother me. And I don't usually like to harp on negativity, but I'm gonna today. The first one that people bother about, or the first one that people gnash on their teeth about this movie is the length. And yes, it is a 2-hour and 45-minute movie. It's by the time you're done with trailers and commercials, you're in the theater for 3 hours. I don't know why that is a problem. I understand that we as a society are getting more ADD by the day, but people did not cry foul over 2 hours and 45 minutes of Dark Knight Rises. They didn't cry foul over 2.5 hours of Inglourious Basterds. They didn't cry foul over 2.5 hours of Avengers. But give them something like this that's philosophical and earnest and sprawling and epic, and all of a sudden everybody's got a bladder the size of a peanut.
And I see where you're going with that, and I think that's the exact reason for it. There is a great deal of spectacle here, but it is something that you cannot shut your brain off for.
No.
And it's 2 hours and 45 minutes of thinky time. And that's, you know, if you're not up for that, I can see it being a problem. Now, I will say that I very rarely go to the theater, and when I go to the theater, I never get snacks. I did for this, and the theater I went to has essentially redefined what a large Coke is into something you can.
It's a bucket and a lid, isn't it?
Yes, something you can actually park a boat in. And by the end, I was saying, "Oh God, please end! I have to pee." But I did not feel the need to get up. I did not ever feel disengaged from it, and I was never bored by it.
Yeah.
So I don't have a problem with the running time.
Yeah,
I really don't.
Me neither, and I think that's my thing, is I think before somebody complains it's long, is I'm wondering if that's just people's go-to when they have a negative reaction to a film. I don't think anything is really too long. Once in a while, you might get something that's a little saggy, but I really think that it's a defense mechanism when somebody's just not digging things. It's just an easy pick. The other thing that has been really, really railed on, and I really don't think it's fair at all, is people have been picking on the makeup, specifically on the neo-soul sequence where we get actors like James Darcy and Hugo Weaving and Jim Sturgess made up to look sort of Asian. They don't even look fully Asian. Like, it's the future, so for all we know, it's not exactly earthbound people. But they're made up to look Asian, and I don't understand why this is the sticking point, because we were talking about a film where a black woman is made up to look like a white woman, and an Asian man, and a white man is made up to look like a white woman, and an Asian woman is made up to look like a white woman as well. And it's just on and on and on down the line. Furthermore, the whole point of the makeup is to bring up the traces of one character in a future or past self. They probably could have done it by casting somebody else. Agreed. But if people aren't understanding the whole idea that there are traces of people in other people when they are made up and they're just focusing on the makeup, I don't think they would have got it if they had a cast characters of ethnicity.
I agree. I think, you know, there are places where the makeup, I think, is and first of all, I'll go into this saying, I think we've seen the Academy Award winner for makeup.
I'm pretty sure we have.
And possibly for costume, but almost assuredly for makeup. There are places where it does sort of, I find it jarring. Duna Bay, as good as she is in this, is never going to pass for the daughter of an antebellum man from Virginia.
No, she's not.
Hugh Grant's makeup in the modern day story that features Jim Broadbent,
yep,
that's a Halloween mask.
Yeah.
But I didn't mind it in the Neo Soul story. I didn't mind it in a lot of places. There were a couple of places where I thought, I'm not 100% sure on that makeup. But it didn't bug me probably 90 to 95% of the time. It was just a couple of times when I thought, not great. So, yeah, as a complaint, I think it's a pretty weak complaint, considering how good it is throughout. And I was completely gobsmacked at the identity of Hugh Grant in the futuristic, the most future story.
Did you stick around for the credits?
I did. Yeah. And that was a complete, seriously, really? That was Hugh Grant?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Some of the makeup is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. In both screenings that I've seen, when they start showing that, if you haven't seen Cloud Atlas yet and you do intend to, watch it until like you get to the actual character credits, because they actually show you the faces in each of the timelines, and people were in stories and you probably missed them. Both of the screenings I saw, when these images come up of these characters in the timelines, every time, not every time, but more than once, there was an audible whoa when some of these people came up.
There are a few of them that are pretty obvious, even when it's gender switching or race switching. But there are some of them that are
really like, not.
You know, yeah, Tom Hanks is Tom Hanks, and you know Tom Hanks. And I feel pretty much the same way about Hugo Weaving. But some of these are pretty staggering.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's insane. Obviously we both really like it. So I think if there's one takeaway from this entire conversation, it's that we both really think that this is something to check out, whether it's on a cheap night or if you want to wait until you can watch it on the comfort of your couch, do so. But don't really believe the negativity about this film. There is a lot to like about Cloud Atlas. There's 6 stories. So I'm willing to bet that at the very least, if you watch this film, you're going to like 3 of the 6, at least.
I tended to like them more the further along the timeline they went.
Oh, that's cool.
So there you go. My favorite story was the far future, then the neo-soul, then the present day, which was by far the funniest, and then sort of back and back and back. I liked them more the further along in the future they got.
That's interesting. Now, if you have to take a souvenir from Cloud Atlas, what would you keep from this film?
I'm going to pick the thing that I've heard the third most amount of complaints about.
Okay.
And also because I think I know what you would want to take, and I didn't want to take it. I wanted to leave it for you. And I'm going to take the language from the distant future.
Interesting.
Which I think is fantastic. Little known trivia about me, I have a master's degree in linguistics. And anytime someone is really intelligent in playing with language, I really appreciate it. I've heard a ton of complaints. Oh, they're all speaking gibberish. I can't understand what they're talking about. You're not supposed to. That's what you would sound like to if you teleported back and talked to someone who was from the Elizabethan, period. That's what you'd sound like. That's what it's supposed to do. Language changes like that, and we're, 500 or 1,000 years in the future. It is going to be different. Yep. If you couldn't follow the story, you need to pay attention more to what they're saying. I got about 85% of what they said. I thought it was fantastic. Really smart updating of the language. Really well done and very nicely realized. And so I will take that.
Very nice. It's funny. The first time I saw it, I just kind of went with it. Like, when I didn't quite follow what they were saying after a few lines, I'm like, okay, that's going to take a little bit of work, but I'm sure it's not going to be that hard. I'm just going to, like, when that comes along, I'm just going to not try so hard, and I'm sure I'll be able to follow it. The second time through, because I knew that would be the trick, that was kind of where I was paying more attention. And when I paid more attention, I was like, oh, I'm following this completely. I don't know what the hell was wrong with me the first time.
And all I will say is this, if you have a complaint, if you see this and you are just terribly upset about the language in the futuristic story, then I expect you to say the exact same thing about A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, that's true.
I was to say, if you don't have a problem with it in A Clockwork Orange, you should not have a problem with it here.
Well said. Now, you have me curious, what did you think was going to be my souvenir?
I think you might take the soundtrack.
Ah, you know me well, sir. Yes. and it is not only a souvenir I want to take, it is a souvenir I have taken. The moment I could get my hands on that soundtrack, I jumped at it. This is, you mentioned, Oscars for costume and for makeup. I would be surprised if we cannot see an Oscar nomination, at least for score. Tom Tykwer and his two co-composers have come up with something that's absolutely moving and beautiful in this score. One of the stories, music is a very, very heavy component, and they write a sextet, they write a symphony within the scope of this story. And what I like about it is they talk about this symphony as if it's something very familiar and very moving. And in order to do that, they have written something familiar and moving, and it works so well. I hate it in movies when, you know, somebody gets up to the mic and sings and they're supposed to have a great voice. Like, everybody's like, oh my God, holy crap, how I've never heard the voice like that. And the person's just average. So when I heard this score that was so wonderful, I was just rocked by it. And I've been basically playing it on a loop for a week. So yeah, that is definitely my souvenir.
It's a good score. It really is. It's and it is oddly familiar.
Yeah.
It's in fact brought up in one of the stories when it's being played. A recording of it is being played because it's instrumental, no pun, in an earlier story. And one of the characters says, "I've heard this. I know I've heard this before," and it does have that sort of a feel to it. It's very seamlessly incorporated into the movie too, so yeah. It's beautifully done.
Well, thank you for leaving that for me. Well, we rate on a scale of 1 to 4 stars, even though I wrote last week about how I don't like rating with stars. I do ask you, Steve Honeywell, what do you give Cloud Atlas on a scale of 1 to 4?
I'll go 3.5. I don't think it's a 4 on a first viewing, although I will say it very well may be on a second viewing.
Okay. For me, it is a 4. It was a 4 on a first viewing. I knew that I had just fallen really, really hard for something. And part of the reason why I knew that was because I had trouble articulating why. If you go back and you read my TIFF reaction, there is nothing about plot, there is nothing about structure, nothing about critique. It's just me saying, I have just seen something wonderful and moving, and when this comes down, you should see it. I was able to construct it into something better later. But that first experience just absolutely stayed with me. Definitely one of the best movies I've seen this year. And it's been a good year. It's not even like it's been a year where I've had 2 or 3 4s. I'm up to like 7 or 8 now. So sorting this all out will be interesting later. And yeah, it does get more and more rewarding the deeper you go into the Cloud Atlas. It keeps on giving. So it's a 4 for me. 3.5 from Steve, and I would love to hear back from people if you loved it, or certainly if you hated it. I'd love to discuss this film. Let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, Facebook, you know all the usual ways to get a hold of me. Let me know what you think of Cloud Atlas. We'll be right back after this short break. We're going to turn the record over and play the other side right after this. Won't you know you can never go back? I gotta take it on the other side. So when it came to choosing a film for The Other Side, Steve gravitated towards one of the themes of Cloud Atlas, and he chose a film from 1991, directed by Kenneth Branagh, and it's called Dead Again. Now, Steve, tell people a little bit about the movie, because I have a hunch that a lot of people who listen to this show might not have actually seen the film.
Yeah, it's sort of a forgotten little thriller. Back when Kevin Branagh was sort of split time between doing Shakespeare and doing Other. And so the story here is we have... Part of the film takes place in the past where we have a husband and wife. The wife is rather brutally murdered with a pair of scissors. The husband is accused of it, convicted of it, and executed for it, and says rather ominously as the cap is being fitted to him, "This is far from over." Flash forward to the early 90s, and we have two characters who look suspiciously like those two characters from the past. One of them is a detective. The other is an amnesiac who becomes his client. And as the film goes on and they become closer and closer, it becomes evident that they are, in fact, the reincarnations of the two people from the past. And it looks as if the past may be playing out again in the present.
Now, some of the parallels are obvious, but you actually, when I came to you and said, what do we want to marry up Cloud Atlas with, you had a few of them. But what was it about Cloud Atlas that made you think about Dead Again?
Well, the idea of Cloud Atlas, or one of the main themes of Cloud Atlas, is that we have sort of this idea of it's the same, not the same person, but the same spirit.
Sure.
Being, you know, I said in my review of this that these are not stories that are connected, you know, by any sort of anything tangible, but the stories are sort of connected to the soul. And that's sort of what happens here, is that we have this sort of reincarnation of these same people meeting each other again and again.
The cool thing I like about this is, and it is something that they sort of play with in Cloud Atlas, is, and I kind of want to run the spoiler flag up the flagpole for Dead Again.
But yes.
I like the way that the spirits or the souls or whatever you want to call it, the reincarnate of the person who was passed on, I like the way that they are not bound to gender.
Yes.
And that was actually probably the thing when I sat down and watched this the other day. That was what I expected the least, because, like you say, the characters look suspiciously like Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson, not coincidentally because they're played by Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson. But the fact that when we get into it and we see how they relate to their past selves, it's a great little revelation, and that was actually something I really didn't see coming.
No, it's one of the good twist moments of that movie, and there are a couple of good twists, but that's really sort of the key. Bet you we got you on that one. No one sees that one coming. And it's a cool little moment. I think this is a really underrated film, sort of a sadly forgotten one that's better than whatever reputation it might have. And I don't know that it has much of a reputation. Because I dare say
it's almost been forgotten.
And it's a shame, because it's a nice little film. It's not a great film. It's not going to make anyone forget Citizen Kane. But it is really entertaining and fun to watch. Yeah. And that's really all I wanted from it when I saw it.
Yeah. Another thing that I liked about it and how you chose it to basically double feature with Cloud Atlas for me, because I did actually watch them. I watched one night and the other the next morning. Was that it, like Cloud Atlas, believes in the traces of us that return, you know, like the soul that returns and goes into another spirit or another body or whatever. But unlike Cloud Atlas, it's more interested in karma. You know, like Cloud Atlas doesn't really play in that part of the sandbox, which, Lord knows, it's got enough other toys happening in the sandbox. That's one last thing it needs. But I always like the idea of what we do in one life, we might have a chance to get ours in the next. And that really comes up in Dead Again.
Yes, it does. And one of the things I like about this movie a lot is that Robin Williams is the kind of an actor who, when he's good, he's very good, but when he's bad, he's really bad. And he needs someone with a firm hand to sort of rein him in. And Braun does a great job of reining him in. It's a good performance from him. And that can be rare.
Yeah, because he is really the one who spells out the idea of karma and what happens to us in one life and what we're able to do in the next life. That really all rests down on Robin Williams, who is he even in the opening credits? I don't think he is.
Yeah, he's a minor character. He's only in it a little bit, but he's really good in the part that he's in. And yeah, he's not a major player. It's a fun little movie. And really one that I think deserves to be remembered more than it is. Like I said, it's never going to set the world on fire, but it's a good, you know, I want to watch something I haven't seen and I don't want to watch something that's going to be too dumb. It's, you know, it's a good movie for just something to watch that you haven't seen before.
Yeah, that's for sure. Was there anything else about it that you really kind of, that made you think about Cloud Atlas or that it got brought up at that time?
That was the main thing, is that it does have this sort of connection of you know, past lives impacting the present lives and souls sort of recurring and oftentimes repeating or encountering the same problems. You know, that whole idea of we keep making the same mistakes. Well, the same sort of thing happens here, of making the same mistakes or almost making the same mistakes.
Yeah.
So there is sort of that thematic through line.
That's true. And if you had a takeaway for somebody who's coming into it for the first time, like what was it when you first saw Dead Again that you really kind of latched onto and has stuck with you for, 20 years now?
I think I probably saw it the first time in about 97 or 98. And I would say, and this is going to sound very strange, but it's a movie that has this sort of supernaturally type element to it. And my wife really liked it. And that's really rare for her. So part of me keeps thinking this movie must be better than I think it is, or better than people think it is, because my wife, who hates supernatural things, actually really dug it.
I'm a believer in that kind of litmus test for a film. You know, if it's a film that I think is long, or if it's a film that I think is is heavy and somebody who doesn't like long films or heavy films digs it. I know, I'm a believer in that, so that's a good one for sure. There we are, Dead Again, 1991. Check it out if you haven't. It definitely makes a nice little pairing with Cloud Atlas. And hey, folks, it's 100 minutes. It's not even 3 hours, so you can fit it in. Well, we'll be back right after this with my take on The Other Side in just a moment. The easy comparison for me when it came time to watch Cloud Atlas, and for some people who I know, the better film, if you will, although I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, comes from 2006. It is a film directed by Darren Aronofsky. It is The Fountain. And if you've never seen The Fountain, it's, well, it's heady. It's three stories told over three separate timelines, not unlike Cloud Atlas, although about half as much. And it goes to the distant past of Spain. It sets itself in the present. And it goes to some sort of a very strange future. And in every case, it stars Hugh Jackman and Rachel Weisz. In each iteration, they are some form of a couple. And it's a story all about life and death again. Now, you watched this, I think, for the first time this weekend, yes?
Yes, as it turns out, it was the only Aronofsky film I hadn't seen.
Ah, I still haven't seen Pi, so I have homework to do. What did you think of The Fountain?
I will say that comparing it to Cloud Atlas, and it's a natural comparison, I think it is by far the lesser of the two. Probably the least impressive Aronofsky I've seen, really? Although I didn't dislike it.
Okay.
I like Aronofsky, so that's saying that it's probably my least favorite Aronofsky is not saying a whole lot, because I tend to really like Aronofsky's films, or at least really respect Aronofsky's films. It's hard to like Requiem for a Dream.
I don't need to see that movie again. I loved it. I was absolutely rocked by it. I never need to see it again.
Exactly the same place. Yeah, it's not a movie I ever think, boy, I think I'll watch Requiem for a Dream today.
Even me on my sick days, I'm not reaching for that.
Right. So, yeah, the connection is, I think, is a pretty strong one. It's a pretty obvious one and a really good one. I think it's, in a lot of ways, a little bit, despite the fact that the connections between the stories are a lot more obvious, in a lot of ways, I think it was harder for me to follow.
You know, the funny thing about it that I noticed, certainly the first time and more so since watching it, and I should actually say that it's a film I've, like many other films, I've liked more as I've watched them more. I saw it the first time when it came out, and I don't think I thought much about it after that. And the year I got my Blu-ray player, I was looking just to get a few titles, and that was on sale for something like $6. So I grabbed it and I watched it again. I was like, oh, you know, I think I might have judged that too quickly. And then, of course, I watched it again for this show. And again, I think that there's things to like. But the one thing that I've been struck by the whole time is that the past story, the one that's set in Spain, and the present story, the one of Izzy and Thomas, and Thomas is a doctor and Izzy is a woman who's stricken with seizures and cancer, those two have the obvious link because she is writing the past story. So there's a really, really hard link between the two. It's when we go to the future, it's when we go to Hugh Jackman and his flying tree, that you have to take that leap of faith. And I think that's the real test for this film and its audience is, do you buy the tree flying in space in the bubble?
Here's the thing with that, though. It's because she's writing the story in the present, she's writing the story of the past. There's a part of me that thinks that this past story is sort of a fancy. You know, it's not real. It's her interpretation, and in a sense that the future story is sort of the same thing. And so when I watch this, and again, I've only seen it the once, for me, only the present story has any kind of approach of reality or any connection to reality. The others are sort of, you know, fanciful versions of the same sort of story.
It's like they're dreams, really.
Yes, especially the third story, especially the future story, because that is the oddest spaceship.
Yes,
probably ever created for anything of any medium ever.
Yes, it is. And I really think it's what holds a lot of people back. I think if you put him in one of those little crafts from Neo Soul and you send him out into space with the tree in the cargo hold, people will buy it. The fact that he's flying up there in a bubble and doing his yoga, I think that was what really put a lot of people off.
I agree.
Now, it's funny because the other thing I noticed by rewatching it again is, correct me if I'm wrong here, and it's actually kind of hard to articulate this, but where I found that this film was focused and fascinated on death, of sacrifice and of death on one's own terms, I found that Cloud Atlas was fascinated more with life.
I agree.
And it's a strange thing that it's almost hard to articulate, only that I knew it when I saw it.
Well, I think there's a comment that Rachel Weisz makes in The Fountain where she says something about death as an act of creation.
That's it.
And that's a theme that runs through it. And at times in Cloud Atlas, I felt there were points where rather than death being an act of creation, the act of creation may have resulted in the death or caused the death, but that the creation was actually a function of life.
Yeah, and it kind of leads me into my next point, that when I think about things like that and other films that I've seen that are sci-fi that I really love, including one of the ones that we kind of knocked around off the beginning, Sunshine, I think of Prometheus, I think of 2001 A Space Odyssey, I think that a lot of really good sci-fi, of stuff that has things to offer on repeated viewing, there is a very heavy dose of philosophy that has to come with it.
Yes, I agree. And for me, the big science fiction question for me is what accounts for humanity? What do we define as being human? And a lot of films explore that. When you look at a film like Moon or Blade Runner, those approach that theme. The Fountain really doesn't, but that's okay. The good science fiction is fiction first, science second.
What are some of, just because I'm kind of curious, because I'm coming at it of a different place than you are now, what were some of your hesitations with The Fountain?
Well, the space bubble is certainly one.
I can't argue that. That's for sure.
The thing about
the bubble, though, just to kind of put a point on it, though, is the film was fascinated with circles.
Yes.
Like, his ring, and at one point he's pacing in a circle, and the star cloud that he's going up to, and of course, I think they had to do that. Like they had to do the spaceship in a perfect circle, so they might as well have thrown it into a bubble. It might have been taking the metaphor one step too far, but I really think that's what they must have been going for.
I think that's true. I'm not exactly sure what my reservations were, other than the fact that I think, again, it's a film that I really feel like a single viewing is not going to do it for me. I really feel like there's things that I've missed. And I don't want to say that, I'm the world's most attentive film viewer, but a lot of films where people say, oh, I had to watch that twice to get it, I think, really? It wasn't that hard for me. But this one, for some reason, was kind of opaque. And it was a bit frustrating. I'm willing to watch it again. I actually, to get a copy of it, I bought it. I found it in a used DVD store for $5. I thought, what the hell? So I can watch it again whenever I want now. And I will, because I think it deserves it. I think Aronofsky deserves it. Yeah, it felt too opaque to me.
Yeah. Well, the takeaway for me from this story is kind of something that happened off the screen. When this film was first conceived and first put into production, it was going to be done with Brad Pitt, and it was going to be costing about twice as much as what it ended up costing. And certain things that happened beyond Aronofsky's control almost scuttled the whole thing. So he really had to pare back a lot of what he did. And I actually think that might have given him something better. As much as I'm a fan of what Warner did with the Wachowskis and Tickver and giving them basically carte blanche on Cloud Atlas and saying, you guys just go make your movie, give us the bill, we're going to put it out there. I think that there is sometimes some real good that can come with limitations and needing to pare down your story and work within a box. And I think The Fountain is that. I think a lot of where it gets most creative and where it gets most stunning, I actually think came because of some of the limitations.
I agree with that. And to jump back to the space bubble, it is, one of those things. I will say, though, it's a beautiful image.
It is.
I mean, it's a startling thing to look at the first time you see it. It's one of those things that you kind of do a double take. And if that was caused by paring down, well, in that respect, it was totally worth it.
Yeah. Part of me wonders, not to harp too much on the bubble, and we will go out on this, but part of me wonders if it's the bubble and the tree. If we would have bought the tree or the bubble, but when it's a bubble and a tree, we have problems.
I don't know. There's the part of me that looks at that and thinks, where's the engine?
Well, it's a floating bubble.
Well, yeah. But what's it floating in? It's floating in vacuum. Yeah, it's got to have some sort of motive force.
I've never been in space blowing bubbles. I don't know what they do. I'm a podcaster, man. They don't let me in space.
And that's why it seems like a dream sequence.
There we go.
And that's why it seems like it's non-real. and so I guess on that level, I'll buy into it.
Very nice. Well, definitely two good movies to pair up with Cloud Atlas if you check them out. The Fountain of 2006, Darren Aronofsky, and Dead Again, 1991, Kenneth Branagh. And as I said, I watched both of them hot on the heels of watching Cloud Atlas, and they work with this film really, really well. So if you're looking for some further viewing, you could do far worse. That is episode 71 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back Monday, November 19th for episode 72. We will be discussing Skyfall and all things James Bond. Steve writes at 1001plus.blogspot.com. Do you have anything coming up?
Just pretty much more of the same, but I figure I'm about a year from finishing up, and then I'm on to Oscar films.
Oh, wow. The projects never end.
Nothing makes me happier than a list to check off.
You're preaching to the choir, Father. and if people do you do, I can't remember, you do the Twitter, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
And if people want to find you on Twitter, where do they find you?
It is 1001 plus blog at Twitter.
Very nice.
Or however that works. I'm still new to it.
Well, I'm sure I'll copy you on all of the Mike and the Mechanic tweets, so people will be able to find you if they haven't already. My site is thematinee.ca. For more podcasting content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Blueberry in the iTunes Music Store. You can find them on Listen and in the iPhone podcast app. They all give you handy ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on Cloud Atlas, on 007, Dead Again, or The Fountain can be left in the comment section. You can email Ryan at thematinee.ca, or of course you can find me on Twitter or Facebook. Mr. Honeywell, any final thoughts before this storm comes and consumes my city?
Well, thanks for having me, and I'm glad we got it in before the storm hit.
No kidding. For Steve Honeywell, I'm Ryan McNeil. We'll see you at the matinee.